Systems Engineering representatives of the Washington office of Brainerd Booms, or the office of Men's Peace Flight in there, and then the three center directors, and that we had additional people in the back of the room who would get, come up and give their presentations. That basic scheme was actually introduced by Brainerd Holmes.
December of 61, I think.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And George Muller saw quite readily that this was probably a very good way of communicating. It was clear that in a program of this complexity, you had to provide a platform where the key actors in the program have to be given an opportunity to really see what's the overall problem. Where are we weak? Where are we soft? Where do we have to put more resources in and so forth? How goes it? We have to know in Marshall, for instance, where there was any major holdup in Houston, and they wanted to know how reliable is the rocket that we're going to let our astronauts ride. And we all wanted to know how's the Cape coming along. How can they handle all the stuff that we are handing them and so forth. So I think it was probably, something like that was the only possible solution to provide a platform.
The team together.
Yeah. Well, now, of course, in Brainerd Holmes' days, the thing was still young, and the entire program was young. We're still in the early phases of building some hardware and so forth. So the nature of the program was a little different. We were talking far more about, is this design solution adequate, or do these preliminary tests indicate that we are on the right track and so forth. Because when George Muller joined the program, the program was already advanced. Our major configuration decisions were pretty well cast in concrete. We had a mode selected, etc., etc., and it was now really the nitty-gritty details of making it work. And so the nature of the problem changed, and as a result, there were more and more people joining these meetings in while John Miller was in charge, which however had nothing to do with him having a different philosophy, but was a result of there being now more elements in the program. Let me illustrate. For example, one man who would give a regular presentation there would be General Stevenson, who was in charge of the Apollo operations, meaning that he had a see to it that the necessary tracking ships with all the necessary radar equipment, communications equipment, and the Araya airplanes, and the so-called manned space flight network, that all these things were coming in on time. And he, or some of the men working for him, would give us a presentation every month what the progress was, whether there was a strike in a shipyard, or whether they hit a snag with some particular communications gear, and so forth. And such problems, of course, didn't concern you so much earlier in the game. And the earlier in the game, we talked about the concept. How many ships would we need, you see?
Yes.
Three or five and so forth. But later on, these ships were actually in the shipyards, were a building, and of course they were all over the place. Some little crisis and some outhouses on fire, so to speak, that had to be put out.
Were decisions made at these council meetings, or was it a matter of communication and sort of defining the process?
It was also a decision-making meeting.
And was it more of a decision-making meeting under Dr. Miller than under Brainerd Holmes?
I would put it this way. Again, due to the nature of the problem, in Brainerd Holmes days, we hadn't cast everything in concrete yet. And the presentations were, well, we've looked into this possibility or that possibility or that possibility, and we are therefore recommending option three. And then the meeting would very often say, okay, then let us go to option three. Or somebody would stand up and say, no, I'm for option two, and would argue the point. And the decision was then, what solution do we pick? In Dr. Miller's days, after, shall we say, most of these fundamental decisions had been made, the decisions were of a different nature. For example, should we give these guys the extra 8 weeks they say they need, or should we go to major effort as night shifts and so forth to stick to the schedule because it may start snowballing into the rest of the program? Or, for example, the famous decision about Apollo 8, you know?
Yes, right.
The limb wasn't there, Apollo 8. That was, of course, a very unusual case because it so happened that this problem came up at a time when both Mr. Webb and Dr. Miller were in Vienna, and all of a sudden it looked like the cats are out of the house and the mice do what they please.
You know, a little problem there, but I'm paying a real proud of that.
I would say you could no longer, later on in the program, make a decision and go back from the lunar orbit rendezvous mode to the Earth orbit mode, because these things were firmly committed and were no longer negotiable, so to speak. The problems were more, what do we do now that we have this problem?
Did you know either Brainerd or George Miller before they came to NASA?
No. I met both only after they had been appointed.
That's right. I didn't have to
think of that. Now, some have said that there was considerable inter-center rivalry in the early 60s. Would you care to comment on that?
We had, of course, to learn to work together. The background of the various centers was quite different. For example, Dr. Gilruth started out with the Space Task Group, which was an element of Langley.
Yes, great.
During the Mercury days. And he assembled this very fine team of spacecraft people around himself, and then, of course, with the Apollo program and the rapidly growing desires and the manned spacecraft capability, the plan emerged to build this Houston Center and so forth. And by the time Houston was an organization, there was, of course, a great eagerness, so now that we have this fine center, let's move out and so forth. And I think it was all a very positive, very constructive thing. And it was the pride of belonging to such a fine center that motivated them. And I think it is also understandable that when you have then another center, like the Marshall Center, on whose rocket you depended, that you that there was the desire to control maybe a little more of that than we felt should be controlled out of that. But vice versa, our people and Marshall were also a little bit inclined trying to tell occasionally the Houston people how to run their business, as it looked from our point of view. I never personally, never considered these things very serious. In the first place, I had known Gilruth personally for years, back from our old NECE association. We served on the same aeronautics panel of the old NECE together for years, and I knew him and I respected him, and I also knew that he had the time of the tail. But secondly, I also have always felt and still do that a certain amount of, shall we say, Army-Navy football, if that's the right word, you know, doesn't hurt at all. You can still fight a war together with Army and Navy elements and have a little competition when it comes to football, you
sure,
see.
Sure.
And I couldn't really never get too excited about this thing. I mean, I think this was part of the game. I was Kennedy, it was pretty much the same thing, you see. Kennedy had been a part of, our launch operation had been a part originally of Huntsville, working at a 500 mile or 800 miles away as the launch arm, the launch activity of Huntsville. This now became a center of its own. And as it should and was entirely natural, it developed its own team spirit and its own sense of belonging and so forth. And it may have happened occasionally that some Marshall guys would come down to Kennedy and be told, be asked what they wanted here, you know, we don't need you guys to help us.
Yeah.
But the problem never existed between Cordebus and myself, for instance, or even between the second echelon, because we absolutely knew how dependent we were on each other.
Yes.
I mean, Debus couldn't launch a bad rocket, and he knew it.
Yes.
And we knew full well that he could blow it up, you know, if we didn't do his part. So we were very greatly interested providing as smooth an interface as possible. But I think wherever you have a situation like this, where, for example, an airplane manufacturer introduces a new airplane, say, to an airline, you have similar interface problems. You can call them rivalry, but I think they are really very insignificant. And to me, my years in the Apollo program were really, as I look back at this time, was, I have only the most pleasant memories on how harmoniously the relationship was between the three centers and also with Washington. And I think this is a great, goes a long way, you know, to see that after been through this program.
Well, there were different people, and the Houston people coming out of NACA hadn't had any experience with large program management. I mean, you were to be the first, unless they learned the hard way running in. They learned the real hard way on Mercury.
Yeah.
But they sure were a charging group of guys and very confident.
There was, I think, what really did it was that whereas originally there may have been a little bit of suspicion, isn't he getting into my underwear and so forth, but we've soon found out that all of us had so many problems. You know, that it wasn't really necessary to get any other guys underwear until you absolutely had to. And secondly, we all knew how interdependent we were, how our success depended so completely on the other guy doing his job well, that we were all really best off if the interface was worked well. And I would also say that the mutual respect grew as we reviewed each other's work. You see, in this respect, the Management Council meetings probably contributed a great deal. I mean, one guy after another, you know, representing Marshall and Houston Kennedy would come up there and not only brag about the thing that worked well, but I had to explain the thing that didn't.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That is a very educational process, you know. The way the people in the other centers responded to the problem they had carried a message, and I think it was really an association of growing mutual respect throughout the thing. There's one element, by the way, about inter-center relationship that, shall we say, throughout the Apollo program played a somewhat, I wouldn't say controversial role, but where the opinions were a little bit divided on the relative merits of this thing. Let me elaborate. The following that holds came on board. It was already clear that there would be many interfaces in the program that we had to resolve somehow between Houston and Marshall jointly. Let me give you an example. The Mercury program and the Gemini program have proven very clearly that we have to provide an astronaut abort capability in case something went wrong with the booster, during the boost phase. The astronaut had to be able to flip a switch and fire himself away from an aborting rocket. Now, this is actually a pretty tricky problem because you have to analyze the possible failure modes that may lead to the need to get away. What are the, in what forms can a hazardous situation arise? And out of this question comes the next one, what are the cues that you could utilize to find out that you're in trouble and better get out of the spacecraft? In other words, trigger the abort mechanism. And then the next question was, how long does it take for these cues to really show something? And how much period of grace, how much time is left until the catastrophic event arises to get away? Could there conceivably be situations where it is a kind of a now or never thing, where you really have to flip the switch as once or it's too late? And the whole thing behind you becomes a fireball. These things are, of course, very closely interrelated. They have something to do with astronaut reaction to a warning light, for instance. How much time is left if he watches lights there to reach up with the arm and flip a switch? Can you really reach the switch if there are 4Gs pushing? Should he have the switch maybe on the arm where he doesn't have to reach up there? Is there a danger that he may inadvertently trigger an abort? Or should we conceivably even wire the whole rocket in such a way that the abort is automatically triggered so that you don't need the guy in the loop at all and some little black box decides for you that it's getting unsafe here and you better get out of here and triggers the switch? Now, this latter thing was, of course, a very unpopular thing with the astronauts, because who wants to ride a rocket where a little black box in the rocket decides it's better for your health to get out of here, and suddenly you get a 20G kick in the butt, you know, go. The idea of the command pilot was that he wants to be in charge of the operation, like an airline pilot. So this is a typical example for a very complex interface between the rocket and the front end, both the spacecraft and the astronaut. Well, to settle interface questions like this, we established so-called working groups. There was a working group, for example, for launch abort procedures. There were similar ones for entirely different areas. For example, one was for structural resonance effects in the entire stack. I think we call it dynamics. Then one was an aerodynamics working group. Pretty obvious. I mean, as a rocket gets shorter, its aerodynamic sheet changes all the time, and the responses to the steering change and so forth. So we had something like 10 working groups. And these working groups were chaired and co-chaired by one man from Marshall and one man from Houston. Or was that a two co-chairmen? And this organization some working groups, by the way, there was one launch operation chaired by the Cape, but that was the only one the Cape participated. The other ones were just between Marshall and Houston. These working groups, of course, played a very important role in making Apollo possible. At the same time, their status with respect to Washington was always a little wishy-washy.
Washington view of that.
Yeah, well, for example, when Joe Shea was here in Washington as the chief systems engineer for Apollo, he asked, quite understandably, the question, wait a minute, who makes decisions here? If I'm the systems engineer, these things all interest me and so forth, but how do we decide these things? Is this decided by committee, or am I deciding this and so forth? Well, while the, shall we say, the way how this ought to be structured was debated throughout the Apollo program, these working groups really performed a fantastic service all along, and it was recognized by everybody, really. And I think the best solution, and the one that I would recommend to adopt if we ever had to do it again, is what General Phillips finally came up with by simply saying that he, General Phillips, as the program director for Apollo, once a month or once every 3 months, where he will review what decisions have you guys made and why, and then he would sprinkle his own holy water on or challenge these things, and maybe get a third party in, like his Belcom outfit, to review once more working group decision whether it was really a sound one. And I would say this latter thing really worked very well to the satisfaction of the working groups. In fact, it even helped the working groups, because all of a sudden there was somebody in Washington at least becoming aware of all the many detailed decisions they had made.
Sure.
You know, the working groups probably suffered for a long time from the fact that while they performed most important functions, their performance went kind of unseen.
Anonymous, yeah.
The contractors wouldn't give them credit,
mm-hmm.
and Washington wouldn't give them credit because they weren't involved. And between the centers, there was always a question, you know, they were a little bit looked upon, or have you just sold out the grocery store, you know, to the other center, and so far. So the fact that all of a sudden they were really called in and explained what they had resolved and why, and what had
been a problem for the early part of the history. Identify these, and weave those into the Marshall-Houston system, because it may not come out in the Shea.
You may find that the role of these working groups will be will probably be played down a little bit by maybe even men like George Miller and Brainerd Holmes, But my personal view is that these working groups really made a fantastic contribution to the program that often went unseen.
Did Mr. Webb know about the working group?
I think he did, but even there I would doubt whether, because he couldn't put them so well into his need management concept as to how things ought to be, you know?
Well, I've heard of them, but I didn't really know what they did, so you didn't know how to describe. I didn't know where they were.
Yes, indeed.
I have seen quite a few presentations giving, for instance, to congressional committees and so forth, how Apollo was organized, and I don't remember a single case having seen this working group on any of the charts.
Well, how did the idea originate?
Between Jules and myself.
I think.
Very simply.
Can you recall what year this was?
At the Keep. Jules and I remember that very vividly. We were staying at the same motel in one of the Keep hotels, and we had a discussion somehow or other, either our two centers worked together very closely and really address some of these mutual problems jointly, or we'll have one hell of a time.
Yes.
And at the time, of course, there was no organization existence in Washington, and shall we say, maybe this sounds a little facetious when I say that, but it was a little bit the motivation. Look, there are many problems that I think can be solved between you and me, and we may be better off solving them between you and me rather than having a third man in Washington getting into the act who may not know the business.
That's why Mercury operated, of course.
Problem.
That's their big forte.
Yeah, and in fact, we established this thing firmly. I remember this when Robert Holmes came in. And he asked a few questions at the beginning about aren't you preempting some of my prerogatives there by doing that?
Mm-hmm.
But then he watched them operate, and I think he felt pretty comfortable that they were there because there wasn't really anything else to replace them with.
Yes. This is the nuts and the bolts of decisions they were making there.
And I think the final solution that was really adopted by General Phillips at the end. You know, there are several times I remember the argument, should we abolish the working groups? Now we have everything so fine, you know, organized. There's a chief systems engineer there and so forth and so forth. And of course, every now and then in the big program, somebody would even ask why they are still there and so forth. And I think the way Phillips handled it at the end, that he said, I can't allow these groups to make decisions that I am not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I don't want to stop them, so I will review their actions regularly and then put my blessing on their recommendation or take some action to have the recommendation reviewed. I think that was a proper way of doing it.
About what percentage passed of their recommendation?
Most of them did. I know very few cases where the program office challenged these things, and I think if it did challenge them, it challenged them not because it doubted the honest try that was made by the working group.
But simply because the damn thing didn't work, and we had a problem, you know, in which case, of course, we had to do. For example, the football effect.
Yeah.
This is maybe the classic example where the working groups did not really do what they were supposed to do, and I feel personally more uneasy, or shall we say, more embarrassed, that is maybe the right word, this political thing than anything else. We had a dynamic working group right from the outset, which had in its charter the job of finding out whether, due to aerodynamic excitation or propulsion excitation, any kind of a structural vibration problem can creep up in this huge stack, Apollo 5, Apollo Saturn 5, in all configurations, with and without the first stage, and all tank filling levels. You know, this makes a lot of difference too, when these things change weight all the time. But any kind of vibration can creep up comparable to the airplane flutter that can create problems. And we had this group very competently staffed by Marshall and Houston personnel. And we still had a pool problem. We had pool in the first stage, we had pool in the second stage, we had problems of the lens suddenly starting to sink in its foundation in the slaw up there and so forth. And some of these things required pretty hectic last minute programs involving pretty complicated and costly equipment to identify the nature of the problem, understand it a little better. Now, I'm not saying that we have wasted money by having recognized these problems so late. What I am saying is we should have spent some of that money that later on had to be spent in a hurry. We should have put that money in at the beginning of the program and done this thing earlier at a time when we were not all under so much pressure to get on top of these things.
Now, in your working groups, you had no people from the other centers, like Lewis or Bangley or...
Not in the working groups, but the working group chairman could call in consultants as he saw fit and did that to a very great extent. For example, in this particular group, we had both Langley and Lewis people in. Lewis for propulsion vibration and Langley for aerodynamical vibration. Langley had a very extensive program in the wind tunnel there, the entire Saturn V. We had a kind of a rockery model there, the wind tunnel, where you could really excite aerodynamic vibrations in the wind tunnel in order to understand this. But this Fugo thing was strictly a structural feedback of a propulsion-originated vibration.
Were any NOCOM reps on the working groups?
No, but whenever General Phillips reviewed a working group recommendation that he wasn't quite comfortable with, then he would get the Belcom people in as his systems engineers and say, I appointed Jan Ross or the other guy, Jimmy, this blonde fellow, Belcom. I would ask them to look into this matter once more, and then seriously, this was essentially an action item that Phillips gave Belcom as a result of his working group review, and then that Belcom would sit together with the working group, challenge them, and actually come up with an independent report to Phillips.
How often did the working groups sit? Did they just sit for...
That depended entirely. I can tell you in the final, when this Pogo thing popped up, they sat day and night for weeks. And I think a very outstanding job, for example, was done by the network working group. I forgot exactly the name for this thing, but we had one working group that dealt with the problem of electrical integration of the entire vehicle, including these umbilical arm connections into the vehicle and so forth. We built electrical simulators of each stage on a breadboard first and tried these breadboards, not only the nominal conditions but also off nominal conditions, whether any hazardous conditions could arrive and so forth, and that was a very successful panel. In other words, the automatic checkout done the job of these working groups. They quickly caught on that these things were going on. And in a sense, questioned, you know, where it fit into the system. But there really wasn't any system to integrate the working group activity like that.
I would put it this way, see, from Washington, the question was these working groups were essentially groups of engineers who had an expertise in a particular field, and the working groups were structured in such a way that they could really decide things. And these decisions, of course, all, by definition, involved somehow the overall systems engineering of the entire system. And so it's understandable that the chief systems of the Washington run that going on and that has their own life, but they decide what is their role in all this and what is my role. It sorted itself out very well towards the end, and I think, as I said, the way Phillips handled it at the very end was a very satisfactory.
Well, how did Shea like the working groups when he went out of Houston? Did he accept the system then? He made a statement that he was ready to go to Houston where the action was, because the overall system was pretty well worked out, and from Washington there wasn't much more
at the time he went to Houston, he was happy to go because that's where the work was there,
Now, it is, well, he must have appreciated the working groups then, when he got down to the
youngest. Well, I would say he looked to him, I would say a little, I mean, it was a question really of prerogative, you might say.
So we know Joe Shea is the kind of person he is.
Yeah. And,
he doesn't all say things.
As seen from here, they were maybe competing with this responsibility. As seen from Houston, they were doing precisely what he in Houston wanted these guys to do.
It's 5:30.
Already?
Yeah.
We have time for just one last question.
All right.
Did you have any misgivings when the all-up concept was introduced? When it was first introduced?
Frankly, at the beginning, yes. Now I would always go all up again.
Right.
I'm more conservative in that respect than George Miller was. General Phillips, of course, had also used the all-up concept in the Minuteman program, but then the Minuteman, of course, was a much smaller program, and we wondered a bit of whether this wasn't just a little too bold. Now, George Miller eroded our counter-arguments very effectively. I remember very well how he did it. He said, okay, Warner, you your first several run cluster booster with water in the upper tanks as ballast. And you propose to do the same thing here, don't you? And I said, yes. And then I said, well, now look, what? I said, so don't you completely cheat the dynamic feature of the vehicle? Said, yes. Well, is this really very relevant, what you find in this thing? Or would it not be a much better to put hydrogen into your dummy second stage? And I said, yes. Mm-hmm. I said, well, you put liquid hydrogen in, you have to have a good insulated tank that can take pressure. You can fill with hydrogen. He said, yes. Well, what about the engines? Our engines are the S2 stage, and they also affect, even as an inert mass, the dynamics of this whole stack. Isn't this true? I said, yes. Well, what do you propose to do? I said, hang weights in there instead of the engines. He said, well, instead of weights, why don't you just hang the right engines in there? Well, he said, well, it wouldn't hurt if we had any. Well, if you can fly engines in there and there's hydrogen already on top, now why don't you just say, well, okay, if I get through to first the burn out, I was trying to fly out. He said, George, your argument is...
Yeah.
Well,
logic is perfect, it is just a question when that whole stack sits there and finally somebody pushes the button, how much have you writing on it? And well, he finally won the argument, as you all well know that, but he did. Because the fact that we went all up has undoubtedly instilled into the entire organization a sense of, shall we say, perfection and the feeling that this is a very unforgiving type of a device that sits there on the pad, and unless everybody has done his own work well,
in the 60s, the moon shot in the 1960s, without the
note. In retrospect, I would say flatly no. All our concept was, as a key breakthrough, and it was a very bold decision, and it was the right decision, and it was the decision without which we wouldn't have made it on time.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Mm-hmm. I'm glad.